This is Barry Teichner of the Oral History Project, University of Wisconsin Archives Oral History Project. Today is Monday, February 25th, year 2002. I'm in the Steenbach classroom, third floor of Steenbach Library, with Arthur Hovey, where we're going to continue the discussion that we began last week. We talked about the Wisconsin Alumni Association last Wednesday. One thing that we didn't mention at all was the centennial that took place in 1960. Could you talk a little bit about the centennial?
Well, it was 1961, which was the 100th anniversary of the formation of the Alumni Association, which was begun in 1861. I mentioned earlier Charles T. Wakely, and the other person was Levi Booth, who formed the association. And over the years, of course, 100 years, it began to grow and have substantial influence, substantial involvement with promoting best interests of the university, as well as maintaining this relationship between the university and its graduates. And as the years went on, of course, you had more and more graduates in the alumni family, as we used to call it. 61 was a kind of watershed year in a lot of ways, being the 100th anniversary, but it was also a time when the leadership of the association was beginning to change gradually. But for a couple decades, from the late 30s actually into the 50s, late 50s, there was a group of alumni who formed the leadership of the association, that is, in the sense of serving on the board of directors and serving as president. And these were very distinguished graduates and citizens from across the country who served in those roles and had very high visibility, because a lot of them were executives in their own right and recognized beyond the campus for their achievements. I can't give you specific names because I would mention some and forget others, but I think you can just simply go down the roster of the leaders for those years from the mid-30s.
They would be on the board, right?
Yeah.
Essentially, so
right.
You could just look on the masthead
yeah.
of the Wisconsin Alumni Magazine to get that.
And many of them were national figures of one type or another. So it's important, if one is looking into this subject in detail, to go back and check those names and the relationships in important ways in which they contributed to the university through their leadership and in other ways too.
And these were people basically from around the state who were alumni of
Wisconsin? No, they were from all over the country, actually. They were graduates who then went on to succeed in industry, primarily business and industry.
Mm-hmm.
So that sort of represented at that time the kind of phasing out of that generation, and a new one was waiting in the wings but had not yet quite arrived, and it would later in the 60s as the older people retired, both from their active business life and from they had sort of gone through the cycle of serving in alumni leadership positions. So it was a time to look back, but also a time to look forward. And throughout the year, we had a number of events focusing on the centennial of the association. This culminated in June with the annual reunion activities, which were and still are a very substantial part of the University Alumni Association program.
Okay, great. You took over the editorship of the Wisconsin Alumni Magazine in October 1959.
Right.
Let's talk about yours as editor. You continued through When was it, 1968?
Late 67. I was making the transition in 67, 68. I had left in late 1967 to go up to, I was then called Central Administration of the University of Wisconsin. We can get to that later, but in doing so, I still was involved in the transition from my editorship to my successor, Tom Murphy. In the same way, when I began, George Richard passed on his experience and knowledge to me briefly. There wasn't much time because he had a new job at the UW-Milwaukee, and so he left fairly early, and there I was confronted with the reality of putting out a roughly 40-page magazine 11 times a year, and I'd never done anything like this before.
How did you go about it?
Well, I looked around for anybody who could help me, and it was a real crash course in how you do this, and I was basically the only staff member who could put the magazine together. We had no other help in that area. So I learned awful fast about galley proofs and about paste-ups and about sizing photographs and looking for resources and about reporting about the university. So I was a kind of one-man band. It's like those old pictures you see with guys with cymbals and drums. All kinds of noise-making devices. But it was the best way to learn, I think, because you had to learn everything.
Learn by doing.
Yeah.
Let's start. How did you decide, for example, what areas you were going to go into, what articles you were going to pursue?
Well, there were certain aspects of the magazine that were more or less automatic from month to month. One of the bases for this was the class news section. In those days, you used to run a lot of personal items about people from the various classes over the years. That was a staple of most alumni magazines. And the Bureau of Graduate Records was still then assigned to the Alumni Association, so they would, in the process of keeping track of alumni around the country and changing their addresses and marking any changes in their professional status, usually they would provide information for the class notes section. Another part was what we call the necrology, which was the listing of people who had died, and that was always considered to be important to alumni, because they would look for their classmates and just to know that that had happened. So that was one of the key elements of the magazine, and continued that way for years and years until a number of graduates got to be so large that it diminished considerably, because in those days, of course, the classes were small enough, that is the graduating classes, and the course to one's degree was usually consistent enough so that in going to the university, the students would develop these relationships with their colleagues, and they would know a lot of people across the campus, even though, as we talked about early, they might have come from a different strata of undergraduates, they would still know a lot of their classmates. So that was a very important way of them keeping in touch. And the older private schools in the East, of course, have had a very substantial apparatus to keep the classes together. And so we built on that idea and continued it here in that regard. Then,
well, you also, those were called departments, I remember.
Yeah.
You also had letters from alumni.
Right, letters and...
Was it a fairly... Did you get a lot of letters? Did people respond to the...
Oh, yes and no. I always got letters that said, "Wow, how come you did this?" or "How come you did that?" And those were, and being young and not very experienced, I would take every one of them personally. I later learned to sort of recognize that a lot of these responses were Pavlovian, if you will, depending on which kind of bell you rang for one of the readers. So we'd get a feedback, but it wasn't overwhelming, and of course that's always a valuable aspect to mm-hmm. doing a publication. Mm-hmm. But I began with a philosophy, and I still have that, that a good magazine is Aristotelian in the sense it's like a good drama. It has a beginning, a middle, and an end. So as the years went by, we began to try to incorporate this into the format of the magazine, that the beginning would be news items about the university, the middle would be feature stories, and the end would be all of these items of information that would be of interest to alumni. Interwoven herein was a lot of pieces about things that we would talk about that alumni could participate in. Early on, for example, we got involved in promotions which ultimately resulted in the building of the LVM Arts Center. Mm-hmm. I'll get to that a little later. So where do you get the material? Well, I tried to look around the campus and see what the sources were, and one of the primary sources was the University News Service that regularly put out news releases and features about things that were going on across the campus. There were also some satellite, and still are, news operations in the various schools and colleges or in the other centers where there's a lot of activity. And they had some public information person that could provide this to you. Then the other was just things that were happening that one should cover. Mm-hmm. And so I covered these events as a reporter and wrote most of the stories that appeared in the magazine for a number of years because I didn't have any help. Later I got some funds to pay freelancers for various pieces that we would discuss would be interesting. Sometimes people would voluntarily contribute articles as an extension of their duties or as alumni who were interested.
There was that one poem in one of your early...
Yeah, there was Andy Hopkins.
On Wisconsin. Something about Wisconsin.
I Am Wisconsin.
I Am Wisconsin. That's it.
Andy Hopkins was one of the early public information people who was a professor of ag journalism. And he was in his the later years of his life when he came by the office one day and said he had this... piece, which was a sort of a sentimental piece about the university and in a kind of prose poem form. So he and I talked about what he would do. It was based on something that he had seen done elsewhere, and so here was this voicing of what the university is and its many manifestations. And so we talked about it, and I eventually published it. There were a lot of things that, and this is always an editorial judgment, that I received that I published because it, not necessarily for their editorial merit, but because it seemed important that these voices be heard. Mm-hmm. But from a strict editorial sense, you kind of had to look the other way once in a while.
Well, and, sure.
And just do that, but that's a fairly common experience. And of course, in an environment such as this, there are a lot of institutional political concerns that you have to take into account. But Andy was just a wonderful fellow and brought a lot of lore with him from the previous generations, from the 20s all the way up to when I met him in the late 50s, early 60s. Another individual was Fred Leiser, who was an alumnus who was interested in a lot of things that related to university and the Wisconsin IDEA activities. So he'd go exploring things on his own and come up with these pieces, and I would discuss them with him, and eventually we would whip them into shape and put them in magazine. Fred's interest was in the leadership from past generations of the university, primarily presidents. So he did some profiles of them. And in the meantime, I developed the idea, not original, but in my own mind, it was an idea that I had to follow through on. And that is, if you want to know what was going on, you had to go where things were happening. And you had to maintain these contacts. So I regularly ran what I called a trap line, and I would visit on a regular basis the University News Service because I wanted to know the people there, talk to them, and be able to identify myself as a source for ideas and an outlet for what it was they were doing as part of their daily stock and trade. And I also went over to the photo lab. It was called a photo lab in those days, and the university was very heavily involved in photography, and there were a number of photographers over there. The head of the photo lab was Walter Mivas, who later, or concurrent with what he was doing then, was establishing an identity as an Olympic photographer. Mm. That's because he was from a time when the photo lab was used extensively for athletic events and for game films and for both publicity films of the athletes and so forth. And Walter was a close associate with the former sports information director Art Lenz, mm-hmm. who went on to be the Olympic, U.S. Olympic PR person in New York. And so he called on Walter, who was a very distinguished cinematographer, to help make these Olympic films. And Walter did some films at the time for the UW. And then there were photographers, Gary Schultz and Dwayne Hopp primarily, who did a lot of the day-to-day, both photojournalism and just simply what you would call, what George Gamsky, who was another member of the lab, called bridge photography. In other words, you'd take these pictures of places or people and right. events. And when they'd have a conference on campus, Gary and Dwayne would go out and take the group picture right. and things like that. But they also would take just mood shots of the university, which were very helpful. And if I had an idea, I would discuss with them from time to time some ways which I thought they could be helpful. And then we would do this photo story, and we would pay them for their services. I had a modest amount of money available for that, but so much of what had to be done in terms of photography in a day-to-day sense, I had to do myself. So George had left behind this Kodak Medalist camera, which was an old clunker, a wonderful camera, but it was in the days where you had to, it wasn't point and shoot, and but it still was a very useful camera. So I would load that up and go to various events and take pictures and use those as inserts to stories in the magazine. Now, part of this in order to save money, and being an old Norwegian, you know, it's tight anyway, and so you didn't have to convince me to save money. I would develop those photographs on my own because I was interested in photography, and here I had this camera which I would not otherwise have available to me. So I'd go out and take these pictures in the course of my reporting, and then I would have to go home and develop them on my own. And I had to use my bathtub at home because they had no darkroom. So I'd go put the trays in the bathtub, and then I had this little enlarger of my own, which I bought, and I would develop and print the pictures there. And so a lot of the pictures that appear in those magazines are ones that I did myself. And that was all part of my learning curve. Now, with regard to the production of the magazine, as I said...
Before we get to the production, a few more questions. First of all, I noticed that when you took over, before you took over, photo credits weren't listed, or they didn't appear to be. Do you remember consciously starting to list those photo credits?
Oh, yeah, that was because... I think when people do something that is has something more than just a pedestrian dimension to it... that it's important to recognize their talents. It's also
absolutely
a political concern. I had to go to these people often and ask them for favors, and the only thing I could give them was the exposure and a credit line. So they could walk around with some copies of the magazine and show their friends and say, look, I did this. And so that was a very inexpensive way to get cooperation from these people, and I think this is a very important aspect of this. As you know, in the early days of Time magazine, nobody ever got any bylines at all in that magazine. Even such distinguished writers as the great film critic James Agee was never identified by name and under his the work that he would produce in Time. Other publications.
Well, I'm one of those people, when I go to a movie, I will stay to the end of the credits. I want to, not that I'm that interested in who the assistant carpenters were, but because I think these people worked on the film and deserve at least us sitting there, so I agree. Also, you said that you would stop by news service. One of your trap lines was a news service. Who were the people, were there any people in particular?
Oh, yeah, there was a whole generation there, too. Most of these folks had gone to the university in the late 30s, and were very active in those days in the Daily Cardinal. And one of the old-timers there was Bob Foss. And Bob I think he came out of some kind of daily or weekly journalism and came here to work for the university in the late 20s, early 30s, worked for the news service and was considered at that time the head PR person. And one of the things that was a part of what was happening in the 30s then was the further extrapolation, if you will, of the Wisconsin idea. So Bob, being an intuitive PR guy, said we got to have a sort of slogan for all of this. And a lot of this occurred through the extension activities, and some of it was the activities within the departments and other parts of the university. So Bob went looking around, and of course they focused on Charles Van Hise, and during his presidency he said something to the effect, I shall never rest content until the beneficent influence of the university reaches every home in the state. That's a paraphrase, but it's pretty close. And so Bob took a look at this and figured, well, maybe we better simplify that and just say the boundaries of the campus are the boundaries of the state. Now, Van Hise gets credit for this, but it was actually Bob who synthesized that into that slogan, which is, of course, with us today still.
Very important in the history, yeah, right. PR so, history, especially of this university.
Exactly. So Bob was there, and he and Gary Schultz, the photographer, were great trout fishermen, so they'd always run out to Black Earth, Black Earth Creek there, and do trout fishing. Bob had a little farm out there, and he raised trout on the spot, but Fossey, as we called him, would always, if he wasn't available, you see, he had he was assigned to the College of Engineering also to work on their stuff, so he had the advantage of always being in transit. He was either
always at the other place.
Yeah, right. He was either on the hill or not. Now, the director of the news service and the assistant to the president, this was before we had chancellors, was Bob Taylor. And Bob was part of a triumvirate that had returned from World War II and had gotten positions in the E.B. Fred administration. It was Bob Taylor and Clay Shainfield and Scott Cutlip. And to simplify, Bob won the brass ring for being the public information officer of the university and the assistant to the chancellor. Clay was the executive director after he left the alumni magazine. He was one of the previous editors.
Editors, right.
For the UW centennial observation. And Clay was a journalist also. Both Bob and Clay were active on the Daily Cardinal before they went off to service or graduated. And so Clay went in that direction and later became a member of the wildlife faculty here. Wildlife referring to animals and not college pranks and so forth. And studied under Aldo Leopold, who was still living at that time and was at his peak in terms of his influence on study of wildlife, which later became wildlife ecology, Department of Wildlife Ecology. And so Clay really was the coordinator behind the centennial, UW centennial observations, and put together a lot of material which is still very useful today. Two primary resources were the History Digest that was put together, mm-hmm. and then Clay did a little booklet about the influence that the university had on a local community, and he picked his own hometown of Lake Mills to do this, and he put together this little booklet for that purpose. That left Scott Cutlip, who had to find some other ways of staying at the university and making a name for himself. So he decided to pursue his fortunes in journalism, School of Journalism. And of course, as they say, the rest is history, because Scott became one of the premier figures in the development of public relations as a field, and wrote the basic text for it, which was for years and years used across the country. So Bob Taylor was head of the news service. And there were others there. Jack Newman was his deputy. Jack was a UW graduate who began his career as a broadcaster for the local WIBA radio station, which was owned by the Capital Times in those days. And then Jack was brought on to be the deputy or assistant director of the University News Service. Others on the staff included Jack Burke, who had worked for several years as the PR person for the Frank Lloyd Wright foundation. Not foundation, but I mean, he was Frank Lloyd Wright, the Taliesin Fellowship, PR person, a former AP newspaper man. Another was Hazel McGrath, who was a single parent in those days, raising a family, and had some journalism background. Another was Vivian Hone, H-O-N-E, whose husband Harold was a very distinguished photographer in Madison and did a lot of portraits of university figures. And
excellent portraits.
Yeah.
Vivian was a writer.
Vivian was a writer who covered some of the departments of the university, like a newspaper the News Service had then and still does, for that matter, a beat system whereby the various writers would be assigned to departments or schools and colleges, and they would make contacts there and write stories in that regard. That was the composition primarily of the News Service when I arrived, and it had been quite well established and running with those individuals involved for a number of years before.
Where was that? That was in Basketball?
It was in the Observatory, what we now call the Observatory Hill office building, which was the old president's home up in through the 1870s, before I believe it was Adams moved down to the Langdon Street address, which became the president's home. So they had the first floor there, and the second floor was occupied by the School of Social Work, which later became quite famous, but at that time it had two individuals, Helen I. Clark and Arthur Miles were the primary members of the faculty in those days. It began to grow also dramatically during this period. And in the basement of the building, the News Service maintained its facilities to reproduce its material, news releases, and various other related activities. The Photo Media Center was on Johnson Street and occupied three old houses. Mm. And so you'd go through this rabbit warren almost of these various dark rooms and studios that were located in these three old homes on the site of where the current psychology building, Brogdon Hall, is located.
Interesting.
Activity was primarily to just go around from day to day and check out things and see who was doing what, and then to work with them and getting material for the magazine.
Great. How much autonomy did you have in terms of selecting what you were going to feature and things like that? Was it pretty much your call?
Well, it developed that way, but initially John Burgee wanted to see all the copy for the magazine before we went to press. And I can understand that from one standpoint. Here was this young guy who had not really proven himself in any way and was an unknown quantity, so Burgee wanted to look at the material. So during a time, which was fairly brief, couple of years, that he was still executive director, I pretty much had to make sure that John Burgee understood what I was doing and that he had to look at much of the stuff that would go in the magazine. Of course, he didn't look at the class news and things
right.
like that.
Yeah. Now, before we get to your actual production of the magazine, Arlie Mux Jr. Mm-hmm. took over for Burgee after, you said, a couple of years, and he wrote an editorial column. Is there anything you need to say about that?
Well, we thought it was important for Arlie to identify himself through this mechanism, and that was part of the beginning, middle, and end concept, as the beginning should be a statement from the executive director, sort of a view from the campus, and a way of informing alumni about issues both relating to the Alumni Association and to the university at large. So this was a personalization of the Alumni Association to its larger constituency. And of course, as it grew and people were spread all over the country, they wouldn't necessarily know this person on a day-to-day basis. So this was a regular way of reaching them. And that technique is still used quite often. It's given over to university officials as a means of their reaching the alumni. And we did that from time to time also, both with the President Alumni Association and the administration of the university, when appropriate.
Okay. Okay, you're getting ready to, it's March, or September's coming up, or whatever month you want.
Yeah.
You're going to get ready to put the magazine together. Tell me the process.
Well,
from beginning to end.
I just, I sort of knew what, in the larger sense, was involved here, but I didn't know specifically about what you had to do on a month-to-month basis to produce this thing. The first thing is you had to generate the copy, of course. So that was part of my trap line visitations, is to get copy from the sources that were already there. Then, of course, I had to prepare the class news, which meant that the alumni records people would put these items that they would get, usually clippings from newspapers, because we did subscribe to a clipping service, which would provide those, and those were used to change the records as well as to provide items for class news. So they put them in folders, usually by decades, and then I just sort them out and then write them up, short items, usually a sentence or two. So that was the back of the book material, and then one of the clerical people in the Alumni Records Office would do the necrology, and I think maybe even we were running weddings in those days. I'm not sure. I'd have to go back and
I think you did some weddings.
Yeah. So that material would be supplied to me, and I would process it. Then I would get the news releases, and I would often edit the copy there. And then I would have to get these feature stories from various people or do them myself. So the first chore was to get something to publish and have some overarching concept of what you were going to do. Well, because I had established a relationship with a lot of these people across the campus, they would come to me with ideas, or I would see things that I thought were interesting, and I would solicit them to do things. So once you got all of this together, there was then the problem of getting the typeset. So I'd have to send it off to Democrat Printing, as I mentioned earlier, which was the firm that printed the magazine, Walter Frauci firm, later became Webcrafters. And so I would send it off, and they would then typeset it in Linotype machines, because this was all printed letterpress, meaning directly from cast type. So this was still using a technology that had been used
a long time
immemorial, since Gutenberg, that is setting individual letters to make words and so forth and so on. And Linotype merely did that in terms of a casting of a line of type. And machines would do this using matrices of type. And these would be dropped down into a line, and then the line would be cast in lead, and you'd go on to the next line, and so forth and so on. And then this would be a block of type, which would be put on this tray. which was called a galley. And then they would pull a proof, meaning they would print the type on a sheet of paper, and those were the galley proof. So I would get those back, and then I would have to lay the magazine out. A lot of this took prior planning to figure how much, approximately how much type you were going to get. And then you had to, the whole other part of this was the photos. So you had to decide what size the photos would be, where they would be placed. And then once you size the photos, we would send them off to Wyden Engraving Company here in town, and they would make these dot engravings of the photos, and those would come back in blocks. The engraving would be mounted on a block, which was as high as the type, so it would conform to the surface that was to be printed. Much of this involved then prior planning, what you were going to put on what pages and so forth. Eventually I developed this little system where I drew 40 squares on a sheet of paper, and then I would jot down in each square approximately what was going to be placed there. We also at that time had advertising, which was supplied to us through a national broker. So they would sell advertising on the basis of groups of magazines, Big Ten being one. Mm-hmm. And we would get these ads that we would place in the magazine. That was a source of revenue. And sometimes I'd go out and sell local ads based on some event we were having, like a reunion and so forth. So I, at times I would go out and beat the pavement selling ads to local motels, because this would, the magazine would go out to these people who are coming back to campus. So I was an ad salesman at the time too, which was a horrible waste of time and energy, really, for the revenue that you received selling local ads. It was much more convenient to have a broker do it for you.
What would you get for a Lego?
Oh, I don't even remember, but if you took the full page, you wouldn't pay for it. Cost of me going out and doing it. So this was part of it, and then eventually you had to put the whole magazine together in layout form on these sheets, and then that would go back to the printer, and the printer, namely the compositor, I guess you would say, would make up these pages containing the metal type and the photo engravings, and then that would be put into these big forms, which would print these sheets. This is the letterpress, so you had these large sheets, which then would be folded and eventually trimmed, and that was the magazine. So I had to learn this whole process, and there were times that I would be out there at Web Crafters working right next to the printer, was making up the pages and seeing that they would be made up consistent with a layout, or they would call me and say, this isn't going to fit, you got to do some editing here and so forth. And eventually we get the magazine put together. But my responsibility was from my bathtub, if you will, to the press that ran the magazine in preparing it for its final compilation. And then after that, of course, we had to address it. And
yeah, that's the next.
Magazines would come back here, and I mentioned earlier the Graduate Records Office maintaining these mailing labels, and the magazines would come back to the campus, and they would be addressed with this old address graph machine, and then they would be sent off to the post office.
How did the old address graph machine work? I'm not familiar with those. Either. Just
well, you would have a magazine, if you will, no pun intended, just like putting bullets in a magazine, of these metal address labels. And then you had this machine where you would insert the magazine, and then you had a foot treadle, and you'd the magazine of addresses, and then you would push manually magazines into this machine and press the treadle,
oh,
and they would address the back of the magazine in the
one
appropriate
at a
place.
Boom,
yeah,
boom, boom.
Yeah. So all of this was done manually. And it took about 2 to 3 days to address the magazine, working, two people working full 8-hour shifts. And then they had to be bundled and sent off to the post office.
Yes.
So those were the days where there was an awful lot of work behind what eventually arrived in somebody's living room.
What was approximate circulation, do you remember, of the magazine?
Oh, I think we were about 20,000.
Did you lose money on it? Was it break even? Did you make any money on it? Or?
Well, this was the cost of doing business. I mean, we keyed our membership to the staff and the cost of the magazine. So the magazine was part of your membership fee.
I see. Okay.
So all of that got factored
into
the total
yeah.
association budget.
Got to ask you this question. What kind of typewriter did you have?
I started out with my own Olympus portable at home, and then on the job, I think I had a Royal, which was a very popular typewriter.
I had a Royal when I was a student, yeah. They were very good.
But I had a little portable one at home, which was German-made Olympus, which is a wonderful typewriter. But in those days, and I was doing a lot of writing of my own on the side, if you were typing a manuscript and wanted to make changes, you had to go back and start all over again, retyping it. Of course, from a journalistic standpoint, there are a lot of times where you could just literally cut and paste. That's where that comes from, is that you would cut sections out and paste them into new sections, because then it would go to the line of type operator and they would do the adjustment in that regard.
You talk to young people today who aren't familiar with that kind of thing, and they just can't. I mean, now if you want to change a character's name, let's say, after you write a novel from Joe to Alexander, all you have to do is it takes 10 seconds, it repaginates, it does everything automatically. And back in the old days, you would have had to pretty much retype the whole
novel.
Well,
exactly. As I said, I did a lot of writing on my own. I have 6 novels, which are in the file drawer at home. And when I think of the amount of typewriting I did versus the amount of actual writing, it's just staggering that you put together a manuscript and then you wanted to make a lot of changes. And this was true even of articles. Then you'd have to go back and retype
it. Yeah, amazing.
From front to back.
Did technology change things at all during your years as editor, or when did that start happening?
Well, the big issue was going from letterpress to photo offset. When you did that, you went from what was called hot type, which was a metal type, to cold type, which was of an image which could be reproduced photographically. But that meant you had to create copy that was of a quality that it could be photographed and look as though it was printed with metal type. Now, the breakthrough here came, and this had a lot to do with my activity in the early days of Director of Public Information when I moved to the campus, with the invention of the IBM Selectric typewriter. This, in essence, provided a golf ball, literally, looked like a golf ball with type on it. And you could type on this paper, which could be readily photographed, with these various fonts of type. So you could select, exactly,
you could
the Selectric idea was you could select what font you needed. So in the publications work that began to be done before computers became widely available, we used a Selectric typewriter. Otherwise, we had to send this down to the state printing office, which had created a, an entity they called WISCOMP, which was Wisconsin Composition. And so you had to send your copy there to get photocopy back if you didn't use letterprints. That's a whole another story. But during a time when that I was with the alumni magazine, that it was primarily all this hot type editorial production.
Now, as time went on, you did were able to hire staff members who would come and go. And I was wondering if you could comment a little bit on some of those. One name that comes up frequently is Edith Knowles.
Well, Edith was the head of the alumni records office. She was on the civil service staff of the university and was the person who oversaw the day-to-day activities of the alumni records office. So she was a key part of the alumni staff for years and years in that regard. And a lot of things she helped provide for the magazine. I mentioned the class news material and so forth.
Okay, some of the other people, Alice Weck?
Yeah.
She became an associate editor? Any comments on Alice?
Yeah.
Okay, let's go back again. Start out with Alice Weck.
Alice Weck was the public information person for the Memorial Union. And she and I would work together on a number of feature articles. Many of them had to do with the cultural activities that were part of the union program, Salon of Art and various other things that emerged from that activity in the union. So Alice was a journalist and was interested in providing union material for the magazine. I believe once in a while we'd find some other areas where she was interested in writing pieces, and so she would do those for me, and so her byline appears fairly regularly.
Yeah, I thought she...
But that's part of her institutional responsibilities.
Gotcha. Another name that comes up later on in your editorship is Paul Shaw.
Paul was a student at the time who was interested in a lot of issues that we were working on, and Paul was a little boy who grew up in the house behind my grandparents' house in Stoughton, and I got to know him then, and he knew me, and he sort of wandered into the office one day, and we started talking about various things within the university, and so he was interested in getting experience in writing, and a lot of things emerged from that. He did a piece on Harvey Littleton, who was then just beginning the studio glass movement in the country, and of course Harvey went on to become a very, very important figure in the revival of glass, studio glass work in America, and has been duly honored in that regard. We gave him an honorary degree just a couple of years ago in recognition of that. When he came back, they had a show here at the Elvium, and there was a whole display board of publicity that Harvey had gotten over the years, and one of the items on that board was the alumnus article that we ran on him. And so Paul did that. We got talking about film activity on the campus. I remember as part of the sequence we did on some of this going to a lecture by Harold Lloyd, the great silent film star, in the Play Circle Theater, and wrote that up. So Paul was always there available in that regard to do things that we were mutually interested in and thought would be good feature material for the magazine.
What did he go on to do?
He went on to form his own publishing corporation, which had to do with asset protection. That is to, it was a trade magazine that was circulated to businesses throughout the country about the issues that related to thievery, both blue collar and white collar crime, and people walking in off the street and stealing things out of your building. And so he had a very successful career in that regard, and then still does books and manuals on these kinds of issues.
Harriet Moyer replaced Shaw as assistant editor.
Harriet was the wife of Keith Moyer, who was on the faculty in the College of Agriculture, and Harriet was a home economist by training, but she was interested in getting some things published, and so I worked with her on various ideas that she had about university news that would be interesting to our readers, and we published a few of her pieces. She later then went on to become a member of the faculty. I'm not exactly sure what department she was in. You have to look that up, but this was a way of her finding outlets during the time she was establishing herself as an academic.
You developed a lot of, there were a lot of, several themes that you developed over the course of your editorship, which I'd like to get to in a little bit, but the first, when I looked in the Wisconsin Alumni Magazine at your years, the very first thing I saw, literally the first thing in the magazine, was a football letter. This was done with Jim Mott. Could you explain how that
developed? Yeah, the football letter was started, I think, and this was under Art Lenz, who I mentioned earlier, who was the public information person for the athletic department, as a joint venture between the athletic department and the Alumni Association. And after World War II, there was a great deal of interest in providing high visibility for the UW football program. And Harry Stuhldreher was the coach initially, Harry being one of the Notre Dame Four Horsemen, later went on, left the university and became a distinguished executive with the United States Steel Corporation. But Harry and Art, and I guess Burgee, worked out an idea that they would send this football letter during the season to the alumni. And this would be a report of the games through the season. In those days, the schedule was 9 games. And I think that was a rule that you couldn't play any more than 9 games during the course of a season. Now, for next fall, 2002, we've just added a 13th game to the schedule, and the transparent aspect of this is obviously because we need the money for the athletic department, so you add another football game.
The 9 games, were those against the other?
No, there were usually 7 games in the conference and 2 games against intercollegiate foes. So here we were faced with this Stone Age technology of producing this thing. And what would happen is, I think we produced about 3 of these each season. And the way this would work is that Jim Mott, who was then a member of the sports information staff, later became the sports information director, would go either to the games here on the campus or to the away games, and then when he came home from the game that evening, he would write up the results of the game in a narrative form, And then I would go pick up the copy from him and take it out to Democrat Printing the next day, and they would set it in type, so we'd have about 3 games in type, and then during that last game for the particular edition, I'd have to go out there the Monday after the game and literally put the whole newsletter together there, which included the inserting the photos that we had. And sometimes I just put a little window in there, because then the engravings had to be made in the meantime, and then they would rush that back to Democrat Printing and put it all together, and then we'd proofread it by midweek usually, and then they'd print it by the end of the week, and then we'd have to address it over the weekend or the first part of the next week using this torturous mechanical process again. Then it would be sent off to alumni. So this arrived in their homes maybe 2 weeks after the game had been played, which represented the last. For many of the alumni who lived outside of the range of normal coverage of these games, this was well appreciated, because most cases all they saw was a line score in the newspaper if they were lucky, but they didn't have any story about the game itself, so this was fulfilling a very definite need in that regard. Now, what began to happen as I took over the editorship, I think we did this for a couple more years.
Mm-hmm, right.
What began to happen was that television, of course, made these games available to a broader audience. So the Badgers of the 50s, when they had a great team, the Hard Rocks team, and then when I was an undergraduate, my first semester here on campus was the 1952 Rose Bowl team, the first time that UW went to the Rose Bowl. So there was a lot of exposure in that regard. And then one of the networks began to produce a weekly Big Ten highlights show with Jack Dries as the narrator. So this would be shown in the cities throughout the Great Lakes area, and the folks would be able to see that. Then, of course, just the cost of producing this thing exceeded the benefit of making it available. So we decided that it just wasn't worth the effort to report the games in this manner, and we then moved these individual game reports into the magazine based on whatever month was coming up. And so Jim would still do the write-ups of the games, so we had a little more time before we produce them. Now, part of this was Jim Mott. Another part was 2 graduates who were otherwise employed. One was named Del Desens, D-E-S-E-N-S, who was an engineer for AT&T. And the other was Carl Staple, S-T-A-P-E-L. And they just loved to take photographs of football. So the way this would work is that I would pay for their photographic material, that is their film and the cost of processing, and get them the sideline passes, and they would go ahead and take the photos and make prints of shots that they thought were particularly notable. And then I would select from those and use the ones that I thought were appropriate to put them in the football letter and later in the magazine. But these guys were just tickled to be able to be there on the sideline.
Those are pretty good photos,
taking
too.
Photos, yeah. Yes, they did a great job. So that was another part of the knowing people and doing a kind of reciprocal favor, that is, they would provide me with the material I needed, and I would provide them with the access that they needed. Yeah. And so these were, I always enjoyed working with them, because they just got such a great thrill out of doing what they were doing, and working with all the professionals on the sideline.
Yeah, that's great. One word about Jim Mott. I interviewed Jim three or four years ago now. I have never met a person with, he's a walking encyclopedia.
Oh yeah, he's
he can tell you what the score of the Wisconsin-Iowa game was in 1928 and who scored the winning touchdown with how much time left.
He's an encyclopedia, and that was always an enormous resource in that regard. And Jim started out as the manager of the basketball team. As an undergraduate, and spent his whole life just absolutely dedicated to Wisconsin athletics, and eventually rose to be the sports information director, and then built a foundation for things that would come later.
In going over the magazine during your years as editor, I noticed that there were several articles on the cross-country team. We've always had very good cross-country teams. The Crew, I remember you were a member of Crew at one point, things like that. But there were two events that stand out in my mind from looking over your material that occurred under your watch. One is the Rose Bowl, the 1963 Rose Bowl, and the other is the tragic death of Charlie Moore in the boxing arena, which really brought about in many ways the end of boxing on campus and pretty much intercollegiate thing. Do you want to comment on either? On those?
Sure. The Rose Bowl appearance, which was, this would be the 1963 Rose Bowl team, which was our third appearance. We had appeared playing the University of Southern California in 1953. And there were two notable football personalities there. One was our own Alan Ameche, and the other was Frank Gifford, who played for Southern Cal and later went on to play for the New York Giants and became the play-by-play announcer for Monday Night Football. And then we played Washington, University of Washington, in, I think it was either the 58 or, it must have been the 59 Rose Bowl. We lost 44-8, I'll never forget that one. Because I went over to Milwaukee to listen to this game with some of my old fraternity brothers and watch it on TV, I guess it was, and just got clobbered, just got blown away in that one. So this was an interlude between the Washington debacle and our next appearance, which again was against Southern California. And so we thought that this was a total story that needed to be told. Because the Alumni Association was involved in the tour package. Previously, the tours were handled by the university, I think, through the athletic department. This time, the Alumni Association took over. And so we ran several articles in the magazine, the issue that dealt with the Rose Bowl, on both alumni visitation to the coast and related events that described that week that we were there. Then, of course, there was the game itself, which was one of the great Rose Bowl games in the history of the Rose Bowl. And Wisconsin was behind late in the game and rallied, but just a little bit too late to prevail. They lost
41-37.
41.
Well, it looked 37. For a while very much like the Rose Bowl against Washington. We were behind, I think, 41-14 going into the fourth quarter.
A long way to come, but Pat Richter and Ron Vanderkellen teamed up and brought us back. It's interesting, at the start of the game there was a delay. I think it had to do with something on the field or with television. And Mel Allen was the play-by-play guy on television. It was a big name in sports casting at the time. And our guys got a little upset by the delay, and they were all keyed up, and then the time for the kickoff was delayed somewhat, so they were a little discombobulated at the beginning. But they began to hit their stride later in the day, and it was so late that they had to turn the lights on, and dusk was coming, and then literally it was night by the time the game was finished. So that was an extraordinary thing, and I titled my coverage of the game as the Badgers' glorious defeat. in a sense, they didn't go down without a fight, and some people said, "Hey, wait a minute, no defeat is glorious." You know.
Well, if any is, that was.
Yeah, so that was a memorable game, and we ran that as part of the feature coverage of the event.
Well, I think that the part about the lights the night is interesting, because the radio broadcast I recently heard, the announcer was saying that you literally could not see the numbers
on
the players. He said they were in some points like shadows almost.
Well, plus the with the evening, the temperature was cooling off, so you had a kind of vapor like on the field, and the field being lower, you began to get this cloud-like settling. Vapor settling over the field, and it would be difficult from the broadcast booth to see down there, because the Southern Cal team had on their home uniforms, which were the
maroon
jerseys with the gold numerals,
yeah.
And so that would be very hard to see against the dark background there. So that was, you look at the TV, the film coverage of this, I don't think we even had videotape in those days, and it's even hard to see there.
Well, the radio announcer says there were three banks of lights on either side, and
they
were probably not the kind of
not
banks of light we have
now,
today.
Yeah.
And even then, only three on each.
Yeah.
Okay, Charlie Moore.
Well, boxing had been, of course, one of the premier sports at the university from the late 1930s. Through the 50s, and under John Walsh's leadership as coach, the university had produced a number of national champion boxers who went on to many of them went on to very distinguished careers following their boxing days at the university. Of course, boxing was indeed boxing in the classical sense of the word, that college boxing was really a test of skill and finesse more than just brute energy. So this, when I was an undergraduate here, we used to fill a field house with the home boxing meets, and they would get 10,000-11,000 people in there to watch a boxing match. And this continued into the 60s, and Charlie Moore was one of those boxers who showed extraordinary skill. And he was knocked out and then left the arena and collapsed in the dressing room, and they rushed him to the hospital. And Professor Javid, who's a member of our neurological staff, had to do an emergency operation on him for what was called a subdural hematoma, which was a a breaking of a blood vessel in the brain, and Charlie never recovered from that. And the story was, for that one, I used T.S. Eliot saying, April is the cruelest month, which is part of his Wasteland poem. And this was when the fight was held, and Charlie subsequently died from his injuries. And then, of course, the story after that was the faculty consideration of the future of intercollegiate athletics, boxing as a sport here at the university. And they eventually voted to discontinue participation, which was, in essence, a death knell for intercollegiate boxing across the country. And eventually the NCAA, I believe, withdrew it as an intercollegiate sport. So when I wrote the story, it had to do with Charlie's tragic death and then the subsequent activity of the faculty considering and eventually deciding to discontinue it.
Wasn't it like his last bout as a senior? It seems like it was right near the very, very end of
yeah.
his career that this
yeah,
happened.
Yeah, I believe so.
Mm-hmm. Had boxing been under attack prior to
Well, there were always these attack
might be a strong word, but...
Well, I think there were always people who had doubts about it because, of course, the... in one sense, the desired end is to pulverize your opponent, namely knock him out, whereas really much of intercollegiate athletics have revolved around skill and the ability to score points. And in the lighter weights, this is mostly, and Charlie was, I think, 147 pounds,
something like that.
This is the way you win because you're not big enough to really knock people out with any consistency. And so there were always the critics of that, but we had, I grew up in Chicago, as I mentioned many times earlier, and one of the big activities in Chicago was the Catholic Youth Organization boxing programs, CYO. And this was a big thing for kids to come off the streets.
Right.
And get them involved in an activity. And so that was part of the culture in cities across the country, primarily the big cities, where the important thing was to give kids something to do and to give them a way to establish an athletic identity. And we had at the university a whole youth boxing program, which was overseen by John Walsh's assistant, Vern Woodward, who would work with young kids, literally toddlers almost, and get them involved in the boxing programs. And this was very popular. Counterpart today would be youth soccer and things like that. There wasn't this huge hue and cry from the general public, but this was a pivotal moment in that regard. And a lot of the boxing since then has deteriorated on the national level because in those days, Gillette Razor Company would sponsor a boxing telecast every Friday night.
As you were saying that,
and
I was
would be
writing
on the radio.
Gillette, yes.
Also.
Yeah. I can remember many evenings
watching boxing was
Sugar
a
Ray
very and, big part yeah. of the sports scene in those days, at all levels. And of course you had great fighters that were very prominent in the public. And they were boxers and some mm-hmm. were fighters.
To look sharp and be on
feel
the ball,
sharp
to feel
and
sharp, yeah, right.
That's now cool. We're back to Chiquita Banana.
Yeah, maybe that'll be the overriding theme of this of this interview. There were as I said before, there were certain themes that seemed to pop up with regularity, and as you said, you wrote what was happening on campus.
Yeah.
And perhaps you wrote more articles during your tenure about facilities development, about buildings, than any other single topic. Could you talk a little bit about campus building in that period?
Sure. One of the realities, of course, had to do with the enormous surge in enrollment as the, to use the old cliche, baby boom generation began arriving here in the, I'd say about 62 or 3, the enrollment began to increase dramatically. And it was a kind of reprise of the veterans coming back after World War II and flooding the campus. And so we had not had any real substantial building on the campus for years and years. And here were all these students coming, and there had to be places to educate them, literally. The classrooms weren't there, the laboratories weren't there, so a lot of federal money was made available to accommodate these enrollment surges, and the state also was in an economic condition where it could provide the resources. So most of the funds for this came from the federal government and the state government, and this relates to the national goal precipitated by the Sputnik episode, the national goal of increasing higher educational opportunities so that we could staff the technology that was necessary to make us competitive around the world. Related to not only the enrollment boom, was the development of what later became characterized as a multiversity. Clark Kerr coined the phrase. Clark Kerr, the former president of the University of California at Berkeley, wherein the government and the states provided research monies to faculty to work on various projects, which meant you had to have bigger laboratories and more laboratories, and you expanded your whole research mission. The university had been very active in this, and I published some stories in the magazine early on through the cancer research activity that had been going on here, and of course through the whole tradition of the Wisconsin idea as it was manifest in the relationship between the College of Agriculture and the agricultural community in the state. So our research base here was already firmly established, and a lot of this, as I say, was agriculture, but a lot of it was economics, too. The work we did in under John R. Commons and Workman's Compensation, and later under Edwin Witte with regard to the formulation of the Social Security program. So we had a very substantial research base, and we just simply began to add to that in appropriate areas as designated by the federal government through its agencies, which would fund research projects. So, I felt it was very important for two reasons. One is to show through the types of buildings that were being built the expansion of the whole academic mission of the university. And the other was to kind of give the alumni readers a visual orientation of what was happening on the campus. And of course, the great story always is you come back for a reunion to campus and you go look for your old rooming house, and mm-hmm. it's a parking lot.
That's
or
right.
A pizza parlor or something like that. And so alumni coming back to the campus wouldn't recognize the place.
Especially with what was going on in the
area.
Yeah,
with the new, the new architecture and building that was going up. So I thought it was very important to continue to chronicle these developments from year to year.
And you also talked about the campus plans that we're developing.
This, of course, was hand in glove with this, is that you had to have an overall plan to make sure that these new facilities were integrated with the total program of the university. And there had been a plan developed in 1959, which was continually modified, which would dictate the where and how you would expand the building activity on the campus.
Now, a couple of people, a couple of sets of people were very important in this. The presidents during your period were essentially basically Elvium and Harrington, right?
Yes.
And of course, Robin Fleming was chancellor on Elvium and Harrington, and then Robin Fleming, of course, was serving as provost. Could you talk about their each of these people and their relationship to the building project?
Yeah, well, let's talk about it in the context of building. Connie Elvium was a very deliberate type of administrator. And he died an untimely death in the summer of 1962.
At his desk, as I recall.
At his desk, and I think I have spoken to you in conversation earlier that in those days I was working towards a master's degree, and I would take courses in the summer, and I was standing outside of Bascom Hall that morning when the police cruiser drove up, and Officer Bauer got out of the cruiser and ran into the south wing of Bascom, which is where the president's office was. And not too long after that, came out, got his the stretcher, which he had in the cruiser, and went back in. And then the next thing I knew, they were bringing President Elvium out on the stretcher, and I helped load the stretcher into the cruiser, and he drove off and took him to Madison General Hospital, where he died a short time later that morning. But he was a very conservative person, and we'll talk later about the impact that certain events had on his life. And so I think he was not quite intellectually, emotionally prepared for what was happening at the time. His successor was Fred Harrington, who had a kind of hell for leather attitude. And you could almost say that it was an act of divine providence that Elvium died when he did and Harrington became president when he did, because he recognized Harrington the importance of moving rapidly and responding to all of the potentialities that were out there and all of the needs that were there. And he did not flinch at all about any of the growth. In fact, he had these grand notions about the growth of the campus. And at one time, he envisioned that we would have 60,000 students enrolled at the university, and we would have a satellite campus out at what was then the Charmony Reeder Farm, subsequently and currently, subsequently became the University Research Park, and is currently completely blanketed with activity out there. But that was to be a freshman, sophomore campus, and the kids would be bused in from there. So Harrington recognized immediately the need to tool up and get ready for this and put together infrastructure which could handle it.
What about Robin?
Okay.
What about Robin Fleming? Did he, was it really Fred Harrington who was calling the shots on that level, or did Fleming?
Yeah, I think Fleming really, in his role, began to develop this distinct identity, because we were then still a UW, but we weren't, we didn't assimilate till much later the state universities. So our university in those days was composed of the various entities, namely the main campus here at Madison, but then there was the Milwaukee campus,
right.
And then under Harrington, we subsequently created the campuses at Green Bay and Racine Kenosha, which became known as Parkside. Then we had the separate extension division, which was the outreach arm. And then we had the what we call the center system, which was the two-year campuses, which grew dramatically in number during this period. But Bob Fleming really worked very hard at establishing the fact that the they then became chancellors. The chancellor at UW-Madison was really responsible for the day-to-day operation of the UW-Madison. And much of the activity went through his office, and the decisions were made there, primarily.
Yes, I do recall seeing several articles about UWM, University of Wisconsin,
right.
Milwaukee,
right.
During in the magazine.
Well, there we had to overcome the image that the UW-Milwaukee had, which was one of a very specific local institution that served Milwaukee. And of course, Fred Harrington had a grander vision for this, which he articulated in his inaugural address, even. And that was, Milwaukee was to become the laboratory, if you will, for a resurrection of the Wisconsin idea based on serving the needs of the urban society,
right.
That was emerging at the time. And Joe Clotchy had been president of the old
State Teachers College,
which became part of the university in 1955, mm-hmm. actually, was a chancellor at Milwaukee. We can get into that a little later.
A couple of other names come up in your articles fairly frequently. Jim Etzel and Don Seitz from the Department of University Planning and Construction. They were key in this, were they?
Oh, yes. Well, they were the architects, both from an administrative and programmatic standpoint, of the evolving development of the campus. Jim was the director of the physical plant. Don was his deputy. I'm sorry, planning and construction. Not physical plant,
right.
Planning and construction, as it was called, and Don was his deputy, and they were responsible for working with the state architect to make sure the buildings were built, and built according to the needs of the various units that would be housed in.
Leo Jacobson was another name that
Leo Jacobson was active in a similar way as part of the staff. He and Don Seitz, I believe, had sort of equal standing as deputies in the program. Leo later then went to the Department of Urban and Regional Planning.
One other name, and that's on faculty, from the Faculty Campus Planning Committee, which was Kurt Wendt.
Well, Kurt Wendt was the head of the Campus Planning Committee, which was the clearinghouse for all of these projects, set the priorities. Building in those days, and it still is, mandated by a procedure which focuses on the campus planning committee, and various units submit their proposals to campus planning. They are evaluated and then put on a priority list, and that's what Kurt oversaw as chair of this committee. So nothing could really be appropriately endorsed until the campus planning committee approved it. And Kurt was dean of engineering and also an extraordinary person who had enormous diplomatic skills as well as understanding the nature of the challenge and what was required to keep the university moving forward. And his contribution in this regard was just enormous. And he was universally respected by all of the constituencies that he had to respond to. Little footnote about Kurt. He was this very unassuming person, but very skillful in his leadership. And you would go visit him in his office, and it was this very plain office with this busted down old government issue desk with the linoleum on the top, you know, and a vinyl tile floor, and you went in and sat down in the dean's office, and you looked around and said, gee, what's going on here? Well, I finally figured out the logic of that. You know, deans are petitioned all the time by the right. faculty for money.
Mm-hmm.
And support of various projects. Now, if you go into the dean's office with this high-blown assumption that the dean's got all kinds of money, and he invites you to sit down in this old metal chair next to his metal desk, you suddenly think, well, maybe it's too much of an imposition to ask him for all this money, and maybe I better temper my request somewhat. So that was a subliminal environment that he created, which I think had a very leveling effect. And it isn't that he didn't want to give anybody money, but he wanted to make sure that they thought about getting the most for whatever dollar they
That's
were going
great.
To spend.
Yeah, I've heard him characterized as rather Spartan in that way.
But he was just... He was one of the real anchors of this university all the time he was here. And of course, he has been duly memorialized in the Kurt Wendt Library, which bears his name.
Well, if you look at the team, it's really quite an astonishing team.
Yeah.
You have Fred Harvey Harrington, and then you have the people from the Department of Planning and Construction,
right.
Edsel
right.
and Sites. And there were a couple others we didn't mention. Gordon Orr and Dick Tipple were in it at that point in time.
Gordon was the campus architect, looked after aesthetic concerns and very practical concerns about how does the design fit the need. And Dick was my crew coach I mentioned earlier. Mm-hmm. Norm Sanju was a head coach, and Dick was a freshman coach, and we maintained a friendship and still do from that 1952-53 year. But Dick was the landscape architect and looked after the grounds and a lot of the plantings that accompanied the buildings and complemented them in many ways were attributable to Dick's consideration and work and putting those in as we moved across the campus developing the buildings.
I imagine that some of those reunions in the 60s, late 60s, people would come back and would not almost be able to recognize the campus.
It would be tough being oriented in that regard, because the whole Western reach of the campus was being remade, and even that central part of the campus with the construction of the what was called the Commerce Building, which was the slope of the Bascom Hill, western slope, and then we plunked in between Sterling Hall and Bascom, Van Vleck Hall, and then, of course, Van High's Hall rose on the site of what was just another slope of a hill, which had some scraggly pine trees, and there was a one of the World War II temporary buildings there at the corner of Charter and Linden Drive. And then bang, you get the tallest building on campus goes in there, and the march continues both westward and southward across the university.
Yes, and also you're replacing a lot of those little houses that you were talking about down with the Communications Hall and the Humanities Building.
Of course, that was the big, that was part of the 1959 plan, was the anticipation that the university was running out of space on the campus, which was then pretty much located north of, on the north side of University Avenue. And it was obvious that we would have to move to the south and east in the future development of the university, which is primarily a residential area, some commercial interests there. So the 59 plan was developed to provide for growth in that regard. And now, of course, the university of campus, in essence, extends from, well, let's see, what's the street running up into where the Brat House is, what's that street?
Oh, Lake Street.
No, it's further east of Lake Street. So it's from where the Kohl Center is presently located to the rail, to Breeze Terrace.
Francis
and
Street.
South Francis. Of University to the railroad tracks. And then there's the whole Camp Randall area, which has been transformed too.
I should note that I put together a lot of the articles under themes, and they're on file in the Oral History Project, and people listening to this tape might want to refer to them. It's not complete by any means, but it gives you a good indication of what art was looking at and what the campus was doing at that point in time. I also have several of the articles, the key articles from the different topics, on file as well. But I would recommend that people go to the archives, main archives, and look through the magazines to get a real sense of, especially now that we've heard exactly what went into constructing a magazine from essentially scratch.